and I just learned the best spell of all.
What's that?
Sleep.
Welcome back to My Alchemical Bromance. My name is Eric Arneson, and today I'm going to be interviewing Dan Attrell, who's getting a PhD in history at the University of Waterloo. I know that we've been releasing episodes a little slowly lately. I should have probably taken a little bit of time off for the holidays because I've been really busy, but this is our second December episode. I'm hoping to get two out in January as well, but we've fallen a little bit behind. But in the meantime, hope you're having a great holiday season. I hope that you can sit back and enjoy this fascinating conversation about Joaquin de Fiori, the apocalypse, and the nature of our understanding of history and time. Cool. All right. So today, Dan, we are going to talk about Joaquin de Fiori. Did I say that right?
Correct. Yeah. Joaquin de Fiori. Yep.
So basically, you released a lecture a few months ago called, Something and the Apocalypse and some other apocalyptic stuff. What was the name of the lecture?
The original name of the paper, I suppose, that I wrote was "For 1260 Days They'll Prophesy in Sackcloth," was the name of it. Mm-hmm. And that's based off of a passage in Revelations. And that was an idea that was taken up by Joaquin de Fiori that basically in 1260 approximately, or I suppose it was taken up by his supporters, not him himself. He wasn't so specific in naming a specific end date or when the apocalypse would come, but his followers, they thought that it was 1260, because it says in the book of Revelations, for 1260 days you'll prophesy in sackcloth. And so these were all mendicant monks, Franciscans, who took these really intense vows of poverty and kind of rigid asceticism, and that's why they went around the world to try to spread the gospel, because they were essentially immanentizing the eschaton. They were bringing about the end of times, because the end of times can't come until first Antichrist is defeated. And secondly, there's an idea that all the pagan and Jewish nations will be reconciled with Christianity. And so Christianity will just become this one global force into which all other religious differences would be subsumed. And that would bring about an end to history. It's kind of like a similar to the idea of like a Marxist Hegelian dialectic, where the end of history occurs in a classless society. But this is from the, you know, late 1100s, early 1200s, and these were ideas that were rooted in Christian universalism and apocalypticism. So that's sort of what I was looking at in that paper.
Okay, so let's set like a historical picture here. So this was like late 1100s, early 1200s, because Joaquin de Fiori died in 1202. Something like that?
Yes, that's correct.
So the Franciscans, they were already in existence. How long had they been around?
So the Franciscans weren't around yet. Come around in the first or second decade of... St. Francis himself was alive, but the Franciscan order hadn't been founded until, I think, the 1520s. The 1220s. Oh. And they are basically set up or given legitimacy by the papacy in order to be an arm of apostolic poverty on behalf of the church. Because was a movement.
So St. Francis and Joaquin de Fiori were contemporaries.
Yes, but I guess Francis was a child while Joaquin de Fiori was in his last years.
Oh.
And And Francis himself was not what we would call a Joachite or a Joachimite. It was his followers, people like Bonaventure, people like Francis Bacon much later. These people would be, they were Franciscans, and they were interested in some of the ideas, the speculations that Joachim of Fiore had about history.
Well, when you were looking, so were you looking at this period of time, first of all, like what attracted you to Joachim de Fiore originally? Was it his ideas, or was it like something that was going on during the 13th century that you were really fascinated by, or what? How did you stumble across him?
There's two vectors to my first like initiation into Joachim of Fiore. That was just kind of like a name on the wind. But the two places that I first heard the name was one in the index of Robert Anton Wilson's Illuminatus trilogy.
Really?
Yes. When he gives like a giant genealogy of the Illuminati, he roots it in Joachim of Fiore. And now that's
fascinating.
Dubious or questionable, but story was there and the interest was sparked.
Well, I mean, the fascinating part of that is like, how did Robert Anton Wilson come across him?
Well, he was a kind of a well-known, not well-known figure, but there's a guy named Herbert Grunemann who was a historian in Germany during the war, and he did a ton of work on spiritual Franciscans, on the heretical movements in the Middle Ages, so the Cathars, and on how the church dealt with them, basically through the two mendicant orders, the Franciscans and the Dominicans. And so he kind of created this giant area of interest. And then a woman named Marjorie Reeves came along, and I think she was, I'm not sure, but she published her works through the Warburg Institute. So like the same people who publish Picatrix. And they kind of together spawned a renaissance in Joachim scholarship. And I imagine that Robert Anton Wilson got it from there. But what the link is utopianism. So the idea is that like in the Illuminatus trilogy, the Illuminati are trying to bring about some sort of, end utopia, but nobody knows what it is. Like, is it anarchism? Is it full communism? Is it some sort of like spiritual brotherhood? You know, what is it? And everybody seems to be debating as to what that third age of the Holy Spirit is going to look like or is going to be. And so that's, I think, where Robert Anton Wilson got and he's only one half of the authorship, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah,
I think,
Robert,
is it Robert Shea?
Yeah.
Yeah. And so it may also be him, and I don't know anything about him. I just know that he wrote good books.
Yeah, actually, and that's the only thing of his that I've ever read, I think. But
The other vector is Umberto Eco in The Name of the Rose.
Okay.
If you know that book.
Yes, I love that book. I love Umberto Eco. He was one of my favorite authors.
So Fra Dolcino, who's mentioned in that book, is part of this movement called the Dulcianites. Mm-hmm. And they're basically a Joachim of Fiore spiritual Franciscan cult. That they think that the key to unlocking the third age of the Holy Spirit is radical apostolic poverty. But the church kept trying to make them concede on that and say, look, you can use property that we technically own, and then that way you won't actually be like starving in the streets and like dying or but they were saying like, no, we need to reprioritize our values to the point where all material things are useless to us. And only through that can we like achieve, union with the divine.
that concept itself is really fascinating. I'm not sure if it how core it is to like the discussion of like some of that other Joaquin. All right, hold on. What's the correct adjective? Joaquinist. Joaquinist.
So there's I see all sorts of uses, but it depends. So there's a Joachimite.
Uh huh.
Or Joachite, I've heard, or Joachimist, or it really doesn't matter, like, because there's no consensus. But I say Joachimite or Joachite interchangeably.
All right, so the Joachimite concept of, like, like, one of the things I really want to talk about is how he influenced our concept of time, you know, which we talked about a little bit, like, this concept of time having an end, but this other thing, the radical poverty, or you have a better term for it, but the sort of like radical poverty and how that aids, you know, the reformation of the world, or the goal of the monks, like, that's so fascinating, and it's, you know, it's something that the church had a lot of trouble with.
Yes, you know, absolutely.
They did not want to give up their wealth. And so, like,
it
in
is
hindsight,
the source of heresy.
Oh, yeah.
I would say all heretical groups, they are rooted in this issue of heretical poverty, because or of apostolic poverty, let's say.
Apostolic poverty. Yeah. Yeah. That's a fascinating one. Do you know where that came from? Like the poverty idea?
Yeah. So, I mean, it has its roots in the gospel. So okay. The Gospels, there are, but the problem is, it's where do you place emphasis on the Gospels? So there are different emphases that you can place, and the people who are defending apostolic poverty place emphasis on the verses that say you should, you know, consider the lilies, and you should, you know, not even carry a walking stick. You carry nothing with you when you go to evangelize to the world, and that it's harder for a rich man to enter the kingdom of heaven than it is for a camel to enter through the eye of a needle. So there were people, especially in the early centuries of Christianity, like Roman aristocrats and stuff, and they had an embarrassment of riches. And so they gave away like tremendous amounts of their money, and that set the foundation for the kind of imperial infrastructure of the Catholic Church. And but there, where the apostolic poverty thing really starts from, like where it really picks up, is in, I would say, the 5th century with the monks in Egypt, the desert fathers, people like Saint Anthony and people like Saint Benedict, and all of these famous monks who went out and retreated into basically the desert and lived in caves and meditated for,
or they sat on top of poles.
Yes. I mean, the stylite. Yeah, absolutely.
That's one of my
all
favorites.
All kinds of, it's like, aesthetic athleticism or something, just different extremes that you can push. And so that's really kind of that was a fertile ground for the development of the ideals of apostolic poverty. But, you know, there's also precedent for that in the Greco-Roman world, but it's for different reasons. Like, most philosophers tend to prescribe being fairly not like aesthetic or ascetic, but to be frugal, or to be plain, to take the middle path.
Sure, but then you've got like the extreme cases too, like Diogenes the Cynic,
right,
who lived in a wine jug.
Right, exactly. Yeah. So by the time it gets around to, what happens is that, like, so there is that kind, those kinds of monks in the desert, but in Europe, the monk communities very quickly, they, you know, withdrew into the mountains, they set up their monasteries, they cleared swamps, they cut down forests, they created vineyards, because the idea is that work is prayer. so that if you're working hard, then you are kind of praying, or you are doing the great work. You're fighting the good fight. And so these monks basically created tremendous amount of value, and they got filthy rich.
Mm-hmm.
Not independently, because they had vows of poverty, but collectively as an institution, they got extremely wealthy. And so there were successive reform movements all throughout the Middle Ages. There's the Benedictines, and then they take up the rule of Saint Benedict, which is a pretty good rule if you want to build a monastic community to hang out together.
Mm-hmm.
You adopt the rule of Saint Benedict, but they got rich, and then they had reform. So we have like the Cistercian reform, mm-hmm. and then the Cistercians get really rich eventually, and that's when we start to see all these new orders cropping up, and a lot of them are trying to become very simple. And Joachim of Fiore is one of these people who, he was a Benedictine, and then that wasn't hardcore enough for him. So he became a Cistercian, and that wasn't hardcore enough for him. They made him abbot against his own will. He just wanted to be like a wandering ascetic and like travel around and basically climb mountains and have mystical experiences. That was more his thing. But he was also grounded and rooted in the politics of his day and age, and talked with popes and, you know, Richard the Lionhearted and stuff like that.
So that sort of cycle of like, you know, let's become monks and we'll be ascetic and we'll work really hard. But then like that ends up generating wealth, and then they have to like strip it all over and break it down again.
Yes.
Like that's a fascinating concept too.
Can I continue on that thread?
Yeah.
So what happens is that, basically, a whole bunch of like waves of heretical movements all throughout Europe start breaking out. We have the Beguines and the Bigards and the Cathars and the Free Spirit movement and all these different groups who are saying that the church is, if they were really the true inheritors of the Gospels and the Gospel message, then they would renounce their wealth. Well, the church can't exist as like a governmental instituting body if it renounces all its wealth. So they started saying like, no, it is heretical if you declare that the church has to be apostolically poor. You can be poor, but you can't demand from us that we are poor. And that's what these heretic groups were doing. And so the church plucked two of these groups. First, there was Saint Dominic, and they basically utilized him in a preaching of orthodoxy campaign, and they largely set up the bounds of Catholic orthodoxy in southern France and Spain by preaching with the Dominicans, and they were a mendicant order. And then the Franciscan arm, they took the Franciscans and they basically certified them and said, like, you guys are certified to preach, but there's a hierarchical structure in place, and we will be able to keep basically heretical outbreaks under control. So the church was creating kind of modes of religious life, various kinds of modes. So it's like, you want to be an extreme poverty person, that's how you feel you need to act, then you should go and be a Franciscan. Or it's like, you want to go and be a missionary, you should go be a Dominican. Or you want to live the contemplative life in your cell, you should go be, I don't know, a Carthusian or something like that. Just, there are so many different kinds of outlets for the kind of religious life that you want to lead. And that's kind of what the church was setting up. And so Joachim of Fiore comes about in that era, well, just before that era. And he had these prophecies about history. He basically saw history through a set of concordances. So he saw that the Old Testament and the New Testament mirrored each other in all of these really intricate ways. And this is something that he claimed to have received in a vision. And it's a very, you could say, Kabbalistic or like Hecalotic vision. It's like the chariot of Ezekiel with these spinning wheels. So he gets one of these visions while he's on Mount Tabor, which is where he believed that the transfiguration of Jesus occurred. In the Bible, some of the disciples go up Mount Tabor, and there Jesus is there with his face, and it's all this radiant white light, and he's there, I think, with Moses and Abraham, and they've got white light faces, and they get this kind of revelation experience. And so Joachim of Fiore went there because he was living in around Sicily in southern Italy. Mm-hmm. It was easy for him in that time, around the Crusade time, to go and visit these biblical sites. And now when you go and visit these places, it makes them come alive historically. And so you start to develop these geographical pictures of the world that are less cartoony or less impressionistic. You start to fill out your biblical narrative with actual places and actual people. And so this gave him a sense of history that was rooted in scripture. But what he did then was, if we have the Age of the Father, which is the Old Testament period, and it's ruled by certain principles like justice and wrath and that kind of stuff, the nasty fatherly aspects of God. And then we have the Age of the Son, which was the age of the New Testament leading up to and just past Joachim's lifetime. Then there would be, correspondence, a third age of the Holy Spirit.
Right, with a new Testament.
And that's where it gets really heretical. So Joachim of Fiore never proclaimed that there would be a new Testament, but followers of Joachim of Fiore did.
So the followers of Joachim de Fiore, so in your lecture, you talked about Joachim never got canonized or anything. And it was probably because of this sort of stuff that he didn't, right? He even though he never said it, his followers were sort of like, it's time for, a brand new Christianity, like a post-Christian Christianity or something.
Yeah, exactly. It's that so many people came in his wake and used his idea that it made the church nervous to make him a saint because his ideas are so easily prone to heretical flights of fancy.
All right. So hold on. I have a question then. So a lot of the stuff that you're talking about, it sounds like, his concept of sort of like the geography of the activities in the Bible and the New Testament and the Old Testament, helped him sort of gain kind of like a spatial awareness of, of the mythos of Christianity. But you're also talking about how this helped him develop a sense of history, and his sense of history is one of the is like sort of a profound shifting point in Western culture's way of looking at itself. Excuse me. But so, can you tell us how did our European ancestors look at history before Joachim de Fiore mucked it up for us?
So if we look at there's the Greco-Roman mode of doing history, and it is largely causal. So it's based in knowing the causes of why things happened. So if you look at Herodotus or Thucydides, they're very interested in knowing the causes of things. And they're also, at least in the case of Herodotus, trying to preserve the deeds of men so that they will not fade in time. And so it's trying to capture the essence of great people and convey that information. And the way that they do that, the way that you find out causes, is through inquiry.
Okay.
So history means inquiry in Greek. So it's asking questions and then following these chains of causality.
And that makes me think of Aristotle a lot, like the sort of chain of causality idea. And then, so do you think that this concept of like preserving great men was sort of tied into how like Greco-Roman religion worked, like or how politics and religion were so closely intertwined, where, you know, you'd end up having emperors and they could just come from, you know, some angry barbarian in the military could rise to be emperor. And just the fact that he made it to emperor was sort of like, oh, he must be divine. Or
yeah, well, he has a divine genius, mm-hmm. or is usually how it's framed. It's like his mind is divine rather than his person.
Or his guiding spirit or whatever.
Intellect. Yeah. Yeah. His daimon. We could mm-hmm. use that term liberally if we wanted to. But that's kind of the idea. It's to create a little bit of distance between his own divinity and the divinity of his essence.
Okay. And so, but then the historian would want to record his deeds, you know, and make sure that those are passed down.
Right.
Okay.
So there's this idea in the classical world of exempla, mm-hmm. of kind of just like guiding exemplars that are meant as like morally edifying stories. And a lot of history in the Greco-Roman world, like Livy, for example, is designed to be morally edifying, to make people think about, you know, the golden days of your ancestors when people were strong and virtuous and noble and brave. And look how kind of crappy and decadent we are. we need the moral guidance of our ancestors of the past. And that is kind of the mode of history that exists in the pagan world, but there isn't a sense of telos, like of an end goal, of an mm-hmm. end point. There isn't really a sense of time progressing. There isn't a sense of things gradually getting better toward a certain end. And there isn't sense of an overarching meaning,
okay.
like a narrative of meaning that is, you know, you have a place in this great, great meta narrative story that you are an actor within history and you can change the course of history or affect the course of history. These are all later conceptions that come through the, well, I would say Neoplatonic and Abrahamic or Judeo-Christian prophetic tradition.
Okay.
So it's kind of like at the intersections of those two things, there emerges a different kind of history, which is based on analogy. So the Neoplatonic worldview is very hierarchical and correlative.
Mm-hmm.
So everything is by finding analogies and correspondences between things. Okay. So the assumption is all of these things emanated from one thing. And so there was a perfection at one point, or a total completion or a fullness, and that fragmented apart and that created the world as we know it. But there are elements of sympathies between the things of this world that we can examine through different levels of intellectual activity.
Okay.
By different levels of analysis. And so the idea is that Joachim of Fiore constructs his history, and not just Joachim, but also Joachim inherits a tradition. He's not purely coming into a vacuum. Who we really need to go to is St. Augustine, because St. Augustine very distinctly marries Neoplatonism and the Judeo-Christian prophetic tradition in his worldview. And that's the worldview of the church.
But that was like 600-800 years before Joaquin, right? So
yes, but okay. He is the most influential church father in the entire Catholic Church. Like, his influence permeates all of Catholicism from beginning to end. There's just no period where Saint Augustine is not kind of like the bee's knees of the monastic world.
Well, he is very fun to read.
Yes, he is.
So you can't really blame him for that.
Right. But what he did was he wrote extensively on time. So like book 11 of the Confessions is kind of Augustine wrestling with what is time. And you don't really have people doing this kind of stuff before him. Other ways of looking at analogical mode of doing history as opposed to causal mode of doing history is Neoplatonism. As it goes into the Arab world, we get people like Abu Mashar who come up with these things like the theory of the great conjunction theories. World religions are produced by the various conjunctions of planets, and that history can be mapped out astrologically. But this is also a form of doing history by analogy, as opposed to like reading into the causes. And so there are these two competing but independent modes of looking at time, which are not how we think of looking at history today. But the question is, how did we get to today's understanding of history? Right. So the prophetic aspect of history eventually got fleshed out in the Renaissance with people doing textual criticism. We have people like Casaubon doing all sorts of philological work. And the prophetic interpretation of history kind of dissolves and turns into the natural theology approach to history, which is, you know, you're using the Bible as a historical guide, but you're looking for proof in the world. And there's ideas like of natural philosophy. New samples are being brought from all over the world of different kinds of animals and plants and minerals. And so these bodies of knowledge start growing and growing and reaching these critical masses. And that's when we start getting things like taxonomy. So Linnaeus or later kind of Darwinian forms of evolutionary taxonomy. But you'll see that the throughout the centuries, the way that people constructed history was apophatically by denying elements of biblical history or accepting them.
Okay.
So people would look at different episodes in the Bible and say, like, is this true? Is this not true? How can we know whether it's true? And we came to a understanding of our current history through this kind of sic et non approach to the Bible. Mm-hmm. And then eventually we started adding in things like geology. But even in the geological field, there were, let's say, schools of catastrophism versus schools of these gradual changes. And so the catastrophists were thought of as people who were holding on to the Noah's Ark narrative of the flood, or these kind of creationist kind of all this happens in one day narratives. So history gets very slowly and gradually built up by the refutation or acceptance of various things in the Bible. And that history was built up through basically theology and prophecy.
So Joaquin de Fiore, would you consider him a historian at all? Or did he just sort of, was his knowledge of history based entirely on biblical narrative as well?
I would consider him a mystic who wrote.
Okay.
Because I suppose mystic and prophet are very interchangeable terms. Mm-hmm. And it's the same with the word apocalypse, right? It doesn't necessarily mean the end of the world. It just means the revelation or the lifting of a veil.
Right.
The removing from hiding. So that's very much intertwined with mysticism. But here's the thing. Lots of people have mystical experiences. Mm-hmm. Lots of people have religious experiences. They're not uncommon, not in the Middle Ages, not today. But what is rare is people who can convey them in a meaningful text that other people can understand and that other people see importance and significance in. And it's not just psychobabble or some idiosyncratic flight of fancy. Mm-hmm. It's very difficult to get your mystical visions to mean something to a bunch of people. And that's what Joachim of Fiore did. It's just that his mystical visions are about the three persons of God and their interactions through letters and numbers and how they unfurl through time, basically. Hmm. And it's kind of this process of creation, a fall, and then of a return back to the fullness of God. So it's in a way a hierarchy of being, but that is temporally oriented rather than spatially oriented.
How did he, I guess what I'm trying to, there's a leap in there that I didn't realize I was having trouble making, but like this concept of, what, I don't even know how to put this question, but I'm having trouble, finding the leap between, Joaquin de Fiore's like mystical vision or his sort of like concept of space in the Holy Land or whatever. So it leads into this concept of like the different ages of Christianity where you have, the Father and then the age of the Son. And then afterwards will be the age of the Holy Spirit. But even that is kind of like the Greek concept of like the ages going by where you've got like the golden age and the silver age.
But those are mythical.
Those are mythical.
They're not concretized with actual generation. Like Joachim of Fiore calculates 42 generations from the beginning of time.
Okay.
And then flips it and calculates 42 generations from the birth of Christ to the end of the age of the Son. And then he presumes another 42 generations. Did I say 48?
No, you said 42.
Okay, yeah, then another 42 generations for the age of the Holy Spirit. But the thing is that before the age of the Holy Spirit would come, they would have to fight the Antichrist. And it's not something that would happen in a mystical other world or like in an allegorical way. It was like the Antichrist was literally just like other nations, Islam, it was heretics, it was, you know, the beast has seven heads, and those seven heads were always interpreted as different historical forces. So the Mongols end up being one of those, or and basically once they would defeat the Antichrist, and then they would convert the Jews, and then there would be another, however, 42 generation long period of an earthly Sabbath. But so what Joachim of Fiore does is he immanentizes the Antichrist. He's like, the Antichrist is coming soon in history, and we have to prepare for him, basically. And that's what gets picked up by the spiritual Franciscans. It gets picked up by people like Roger Bacon, Albertus Magnus. Oh, I don't know if Albertus Magnus we can say, but he was Roger Bacon's teacher. Yeah. But Roger Bacon definitely picked up this thing.
This sort of stretched out like the your everyday thinker's vision of time stopped being like, who's going to be the next king or. Yeah, you know, how are crops going to be this year? And instead it's suddenly like, oh man, we've been doing this for a while and things are coming to a head.
Yeah, it becomes kind of like a new sort of astrology for intellectual people, but it's not based on stars or whatever. It's based on correspondences with biblical narratives about visionary events, right? So the word pictures have correspondences in real world. So it'll be like the last world emperor. Well, who's the last world emperor? Well, maybe it's Frederick II, but then, you know, Frederick II dies and then, well, it couldn't have been him. So maybe it'll be somebody else. So now it's, you know, Charles or it's, or even maybe it's Elizabeth or, And John Dee gets really interested in Joachim Fior. And the Monas Hieroglyphica is a fusion of Joachimite letrism and Al-Kindi's theory of rays. Like, if you actually read the guts of it, it's the marriage of those two things. He's trying to bring, because Joachim Fior read the Bible and he saw that it said God is Alpha and Omega. Mm-hmm. And so he like took that literally and saw like the A was like a triangle that had the three parts of the Trinity, and the Omega also has kind of three points. Mm-hmm. And so he saw these kind of ideas of how the cosmos was created from these letter and then number relationships. So he looks at pairs of things. He looks at triads of things. He looks at, and he populates the Bible with all of these different sets of correspondences. And that kind of way of looking at stuff was very popular in the Kabbalistic circles. But mm-hmm. this is a different vector than Kabbalah, right? Because Kabbalah is coming from Spain.
Well, not only that, but it's very new in the 13th century. Yeah.
Yes. But I suppose we're talking more about like the reception period. So what I'm interested in is like how Pico and how Ficino and how Dee and how all of these guys are subtly interacting with these currents, but especially Pico and especially Dee.
So let's talk about Pico. Did Pico read and know about, was he influenced by Joachimism?
That's what I'm digging into right now. And the problem is that he had works on time that are lost. Ah. But we know that he was increasingly digging into this kind of stuff. And he wrote a book called The Heptopolis, mm-hmm. which I have yet to read. But I plan on it.
Seven cities?
Well, no, it's just like the idea of like the 7 days of creation.
Okay.
And so the idea is that we're in the 7 days of creation. And so he goes in and he breaks down the 7 days. And so I'm interested in how he looks at time and breaks down time. But what's the important thing about Pico is that his 900 theses were written for a disputation to be had in front of the Pope. Mm-hmm. And what he's trying to do is argue for why the Jews should convert to Christianity. Because Pico thinks that he's living in the end times and that he has come, that he has this knowledge culminated in him of these different traditions of marrying the Christian and the Jewish traditions. Mm-hmm. So these are the Joachimite ideas, right? Of marrying, of having this fullness of knowledge that they would have thought in the Renaissance was Christian Kabbalah, the Christian interpretation. Mm-hmm. And that if only the Jews could see the Christian interpretation of Jewish Kabbalah, they would understand Kabbalah. It'd be like a secret key. And then that would kind of reconcile both of the nations, and that would bring about the end of times. Hmm. So Pico has these grand expectations of his own personal efforts. And my belief is that those are rooted in this Joachimite apocalypticism, if not directly, then through certain currents. The thing is that Pico was a good friend with Savonarola, and Pico wanted to be buried in a Dominican habit.
Really?
But yes. But he was a very close friend of Savonarola, and Savonarola and his Pico's nephew, Gianfrancesco, had his papers for quite some time after his death. And they may have edited or changed some of his papers.
So did Savonarola go into his whole like crazy period? That was after Pico died.
That was like during, yes, but like, okay. It was all happening sort of during that period.
Okay. Because Pico was assassinated, wasn't he? He was murdered.
Yes. He was poisoned.
Yeah.
Yeah, on the day that Charles entered into Florence.
Charles V. Oh, shit. That is a really uncomfortable coincidence.
Yeah.
That's weird. Okay, so that was what, like 1498? 1498?
I think it's 94, I believe.
1494?
Either 94 or 92. No, okay. It's not 92. It's 94.
All right, and that was...
I could be wrong, though.
Yeah, but that was...
But in any case, it's around this period that these processes are happening.
Okay. Huh.
But there's this idea, and another dimension to this historicization is the Prisca Theologia, right? So the idea is that Ficino is essentially marrying pagan and Judaic wisdom narratives, these wisdom traditions, as one giant wisdom tradition that stems back to Adam.
Right. Right.
And so the idea is that, like, there is a historical continuity, and we can trace it by tracing these various ancient sages who had various takes on the original truth. But if we bring together all the disparate parts that we've inherited from these different traditions, maybe we can reconstruct that original wisdom, and then we can really do work. And that's where you get inspiration for things like Enochian magic, because, you know, D is like, oh, I'm unsatisfied with the magical letters or the systems that I've inherited, so I need to rework the system and go and basically receive the system as it was used by the angels, or as it was spoken in the time of Adam.
Yeah.
So there's this idea that, like, we are historically contingent with biblical characters, and that the fall is a historical event, and it can be understood in Neoplatonic terminology. And if through things like alchemy, especially alchemy, through things like mystical theology, through different forms of letrism, through astrology, through talismanic magic, depending who you are, we can restore the wisdom of the ancients and basically restore the world. And there's a strong element of Christian apocalypticism of, if you're, you know, among the Catholics, it was, we're going to make everybody Catholic. But among the Protestants, it was, we're going to make a Protestant world empire.
There was this concept also existed in Kabbalah, like in Jewish Kabbalah. There's a Lurianic concept, Tikkun Olam, like the completion of creation, or sort of like, we were still present in the 7 days of creation and trying to, you know, put everything together in the right way.
Right. And you have Tzimtzum, which is the fallenness of the one breaking into its myriad forms. And so that is a very much a Neoplatonic idea that gets kind of jumbled up and mixed in with all of these different Hebrew Kabbalistic theories. Because these traditions are not as isolated as
they're
people like to think that they are.
That's interesting.
Well, so what gets messy with the Joachim of Fior thing is that what he is doing is, it looks on the surface just like Kabbalah. Like, he is, if you look at the Psaltery of 10 strings, it's this, he had this vision of a psaltery, which is like a kind of harp with 10 strings, and each of the 10 strings has like a virtue on the one side, and then it has like an archangel or angel or human or thing that corresponds to it, and that like God plays this psaltery, and that's how like he creates the world. So there's that. That's one thing. And then there's his letrism, which is like mapping out time through using the mystical meanings of letters. And so all of these things, they sound like Kabbalah, but they're not technically Kabbalah. They're Joachimism or...
were they developed independently? I mean, like by the 13th century, he might have had access to maybe like the Sefer Yetzirah or something.
So it, I don't know if he had access to that stuff, but what he did have access to is the Judeo-Islamic Mediterranean world, right? So he's living in southern Italy, which is predominantly Greek. It's more Greek than Latin. In terms of like the monastic communities there, like he was a minority as a Latin Christian, but
because he was in Calabria, which was like the toe of the boot.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then he spent some time in Sicily as well. And, but that whole area was like very, very densely populated with Arabs, Jews, and Greeks. So,
and wasn't that also where Pythagoras was holed up? I mean, I know that was 1,500 years before, but wow.
Yes. I mean, some people have seen a connection there, but it's like hard like to make that link without tracing it out concretely.
You'd have to see what Joaquin de Fiore thought about beans, I suppose.
Right. But what it really does is it kind of like throws a wrench into our systems of definitions, because it's like, what is Kabbalah? When does it begin? Like, there's ecstatic Kabbalah, and then there's like Letrism, and then there's like the Lullian Ars Combinandi, and and some of these things actually precede, like Joaquin de Fiore precedes technically the official beginning of Kabbalah, but he is not himself Kabbalah, but he's probably, I mean, he's definitely tapping into earlier traditions and forms of doing these mystical practices, like Islamic letrism, for example, which is a very ill understood subject at the moment. Because everybody's interested in like Hebrew gematria, but very few people know anything about Islamic letterism.
Are you saying letterism?
Like, yes.
Oh.
Yeah.
Okay.
Like the study of the mystical properties of letters in so if Gabriel speaks Arabic to you and you have to recite this back in Arabic, then and the Quran is the map of the universe, then there must be some sort of mystical divine properties that are underlying the Quran,
which that's total Al-Kindi stuff, isn't it?
I don't know Al-Kindi necessarily, but like definitely all kinds of people were into this kind of mysticism. Does Al-Kindi have letterist works? I'm not sure.
He actually invented he didn't do it on purpose, but he invented cryptanalysis through analyzing letter combinations and letter frequencies in the Quran, thinking that there was hidden messages or hidden meaning in the number of times that various letters were used. And through that, he invented cryptanalysis, which is, I think, fascinating.
Al-Kindi is just a giant. Like,
I tried to get into, I wanted to write like an article about Al-Kindi. And so I was like, oh, I'm just going to go read, I'll just go read up about him. And, you know, 5 minutes into it, I'm like, this is going to take years.
Al-Kindi is just like, you can't overestimate Al-Kindi, just his influence on all of the important, like in Picatrix, Al-Kindi, major source. In Roger Bacon, Al-Kindi, major source. In John Dee, Al-Kindi, major source. In Agrippa, John Dee. And what's funny is that like De Radiis only survives in Latin.
Really?
So like we don't actually have an Arabic version of it. We just have a Latin version because it was so important here.
So here, in the West. We love to overlook the contributions of Arabic thinkers to how stuff
Works language barriers.
Well, I think it's language barriers and just sort of like cultural centrism and at least in the United States we have sort of a systemic or a really prevalent like Islamophobia that keeps us away from it too. But like Al-Kindi, like the more I study him, the more I read about him, the more he just crops up everywhere. It's pretty fascinating. He's definitely worth looking into more. I need to do it myself too. All right. So that's a lot of stuff to sort of chew on. Like Joaquin de Fiore and the stuff that he was working on, really influenced a lot of thinkers and a lot of thought, a lot of, sort of core concepts we have. One of the things that's fascinating is the imminence of the apocalypse, or the imminence of the end times, mm-hmm. Or the imminence of the, you know, fight with the Antichrist. And that idea, like, that shaped sort of the Protestant Reformation.
Oh, yeah.
And it's a huge influence now in the way, like, American evangelical Christianity operates, and the way it even influences, like, international politics, like the
yep.
the way that America supports various factions in the Middle East. Like, it's that's weird.
And not just that, but also radical leftism.
Oh, really?
Radical. Well, yeah. I mean, the entire idea of a historical dialectic between classes, which culminates mm-hmm. in a classless end of history.
Ah.
That is the Marxist utopia.
The Hegelian dialectic, right.
Or in the fascist scheme of things, it's once you've expelled all of the foreigner or whatever is the internal enemy, then we can live in a 1,000-year Reich. So it's really like any form of progressivism
mm-hmm.
where you are moving inevitably toward some sort of ideologically formative end goal. That is, I don't know if we can necessarily say that Joachim Fuhr spawned all of that thinking, but he's definitely a massively critical figure in developing that way of thinking.
We need a new one of those guys. We need somebody to sort of tell us, like, there might not be an end game.
Right. Well, and that's the thing, is that, like, that's the ever-competing duality of man, is the, mm-hmm. the teleological aspect and the kind of just wandering aimlessly aspect.
And yeah.
my approach to it is just that, you know, progress can be measured, and there is such a thing as progress in a way, but it isn't irreversible.
And maybe, and so we need, like, to look at it as, like, maybe short-term goals are better than fixing the entire world.
Yes.
Right.
Yeah, that too. Instead of trying to think of your life within a massive historical narrative that, like, where you're at the heart of the action, mm-hmm. that, like, that can breed some pretty extreme behavior. I don't know. It's like some people, they need that. So it really depends on what your narrative is. It just seems that the world is a giant competition of these different teleological narratives, these different streams of, or directions of progress that we can go into.
And all sort of fueled by the same sort of desire to reach some sort of, like, perfected end time.
Oof. It really is I don't want to speak too negatively of it, but it's kind of a virus of Platonic thinking. It is a byproduct of Platonism and all of the different strains that Platonism has taken in Christianity, in paganism, in Islam, and mm-hmm. in Judaism, and they've all been sort of syncretized. And so, yeah, the people who argue kind of against these ideological apocalypses are usually people who are arguing against any sort of grand narrative to history. They're just like, no, like, these are stories we tell ourselves. These are not necessarily the reality. The reality is far more complex.
Even if there is a grand narrative to history, who are we to even assume that we know what that narrative is, right? I mean, like,
right.
Like, we should be doing the best that we can without sort of assuming yep. that we know what the grand outcome is supposed to be.
Well, those AI Silicon Valley tech priest guys sure seem to think that they know that their apocalypse is going to be the right one. And, you know, everybody's got their own apocalypse.
Oh,
they all seem to think it's very, very imminent.
Ah, the singularity.
Yeah. I was listening to, I don't know the guy's name, but he's this transhumanist guy on Joe Rogan the other day.
Uh-huh.
And I'm just sitting there listening to him. And I'm like, this is the guy that, like, Alex Jones is always raving about. Like, Alex Jones just being like, the Silicon Valley guys, they want to, like, turn us all into spiritual entities and subsume us into the fourth subdimension or something like that. I'm like, that's this guy. This guy is the guy that wants to do that.
All right, I have another Joaquin de Fiore question about. Yep. So one of the things that you mentioned in your you mentioned Linnaeus earlier, but you kind of directly compared Joaquin to Linnaeus when you talked about sort of the taxonomy of time, right? So
right.
So what you've described so far about Joaquin's taxonomy was, you know, the age of the Father, the age of the Son, the age of the Holy Spirit. But did he also...
That's one breakdown. He's got all sorts of breakdowns. Okay, he's also got like a sevenfold breakdown.
Uh-huh. Well, he had the 42 generations breakdown.
Yep.
Did he also kind of look at like a history of, you know, I don't know, Europe at that time and sort of say like, oh yeah, like between the... You know, the Roman, you know, the fall of the Roman Empire, and now this is the, he wouldn't have called it the Middle Ages, of course, because he was in it, but, you know, did he have a name for that? Did he have a name for, like, you know, Imperial Rome and Republican Rome and...
Well, so people living in the Middle Ages didn't know that Rome collapsed, right? Like, that's a narrative. Yeah, people living in the Middle Ages... Rome is Byzantium, right? And like that's just, and the church is the Roman Empire. And so
did they think that they were Roman?
Yeah, they thought that like ever since Christ, and that's why like in Dante, Virgil is like kind of given this prophetic power insight because he foresaw the rise of Caesar, who was going to kind of set up this earthly empire that Christ could come into, and then that the marriage of kind of Christ and the Roman Empire is what would kind of bring about world Christianity. And right. So
I'm way confused by this now.
All right. So the idea of a decline of Rome is a story. Rome never collapses. It just like it changes places, and some of its administrative functions kind of like fizzle out and it withdraws from certain colonies. But like largely those networks become synonymous either with the Byzantine Empire or with the church.
Okay.
And then the infrastructure of the Roman Empire gets maintained to some extent by these new forms. And so for all intents and purposes, that's the Roman Empire.
All right. So then like, but all the client states that used to be part of the Roman Empire developed like their own forms of government, or they start having like, you know, kings.
Yeah, but they all... look to Roman law and Roman authority, and they are all either in bed with the Orthodox Church, which is Greek and therefore Roman, or with the Latin Western Church, which is also Roman.
So then those two like Holy Sees or whatever, they just sort of absorb the leftover administrative infrastructure of the Roman Empire.
Right. And then so you have this then relationship between Rome and, let's say, the Carolingians, so Charlemagne. Mm-hmm. And Charlemagne legitimizes them, and they legitimize Charlemagne. And so they crown him Holy Roman Emperor. And that kind of resurrects in a symbolic way the empire, which had disintegrated / moved / being absorbed into different places. I mean, a lot of Rome was taken over by the Islamic world, or by the Persians, or largely the Islamic world once that starts to arise. And there's always the Huns to talk about and that sort of thing. And Vandals, Goths.
When I was a kid, when we were really bad, my parents used to compare us to Attila the Hun.
Oh, yeah. That's a great.
All right. This is totally, totally off topic, but I really have to know this. Like, at what point did the collapse of the Roman Empire become sort of a dominant story? It must have been before.
So it's Petrarch, really.
Okay.
So Petrarch creates this idea. He basically coins the idea of the Dark Ages. And he
and
sees
he was
like
15th century, 16th century.
No, he's writing in the 1300s.
Oh,
so he's one of the like earliest humanists.
Uh huh.
That's the thing about the Renaissance thing. Like, the Renaissance starts technically, there's like a 12th century Renaissance, and then like people think the Renaissance is in the 1400s, but it starts as early as the 1300s with guys like Dante and Petrarch.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a not a useful term. But the idea of like there was a glorious age and then there was an age of shit and then there was like a renewal of that glory.
Mm-hmm.
That's Petrarch who invents that. And I wouldn't say that he's necessarily he's definitely not involved with Joachim Fior. Dante is, however, very mm-hmm. explicitly. But Petrarch also is kind of implicated in the development of history because he's interested in resurrecting these old classical texts. So while some people are interested in the biblical texts, Petrarch is interested in the old Roman pagan texts, and that plays a big role in developing humanism as we've come to understand it, an interest in translating ancient documents and a focus kind of on rhetoric and getting the message across rather than on logic chopping,
mm-hmm.
which was very popular in the schools.
All right. So it wasn't Gibbon.
Well, Gibbon is the one who really creates the narrative of a decline, that there's like this like long process of things kind of like gradually, there's like a golden age of like Roman excellence. And then eventually that peters out and everything falls apart.
Mm-hmm.
That's Gibbon. So, but these are all steps in the development of a historical consciousness. Like, and it starts with the idea of periodization and setting up, breaking up time into intelligible chunks. And that's something Joachim Fior does very, very competently. And he's also in the tradition of Augustine doing it. But that is why I say that he's like Linnaeus in taxonomy, because Linnaeus is one of these people who started to break up patterns into chunks. And then we basically worked for what we still don't work from Linnaean taxonomy today. We've evolved those systems,
mm-hmm.
but he did the initial legwork of taking a, what we might call a plenum and chopping it up into parts that are then intelligible. So Joachim Fior does that with history. And you can also say that like the astrologers who are Neoplatonists, they do that through the application of things like houses and decans and constellations. That's another way of breaking up time into chunks. And then that all of these different things sort of converge during the Renaissance period, and they create this sense of temporalization.
Okay. Huh. Which again is something that has really shaped the way the modern world works and looks at itself.
Yes. Yeah. And a huge part, like a really, I suppose, dark aspect of colonialism as well, because different cultures, even within Europe, kind of have different relationships with time, different relationships with history.
Mm-hmm.
And when colonialism spread about, they brought this linear narrative of time with its kind of breakdowns. Not necessarily the Joachimite breakdown, but a kind of different interpretations of how time ought to be broken down along lines that were generated from within the Catholic Church. That's kind of where you get a lot of, I suppose, alienation from different groups of people who might be more interested in cyclical time or semi-cyclical time. Time that is based on different intervals, like
mm-hmm.
time is really like there are certain objective, I suppose those aren't even objective, semi-objective criteria, like the revolution of the moon for months mm-hmm. and the revolution of the sun for the year or the day. But other than that, the rest is up for grabs. How you're going to populate that plenum of how you sense time
mm-hmm.
is really up for debate. And these debates weren't over in Europe either. Even by the 20th century, one of the main debates between, let's say, Henry Bergson and Albert Einstein was as to what is time? Like, what is the nature of time? You get Heidegger involved in this too. And it's like, Einstein thinks time is that which clocks measure. But Bergson is like, no, you're being an idiot. Like, there's this element of the qualia of duration, like of synchronicity, of like, there are all sorts of things about time that are experienced in our first person field of experience that are not relative to that which clocks measure as a sort of technical materialist way of looking at time.
Yeah, we still haven't totally decided, I think, what time actually is.
Right. Yeah. Who knows? And yeah. I mean, because there's like, I mean, time and space are relative, but we have narratives of time and we have qualia of how time feels. Mm-hmm. And so at that point, it's like, okay, maybe it's not technically a real thing, but at that point it's like, is love technically a real thing, or like that, like it gets you down those kind of holes.
Do we have a love clock yet? Can you measure love?
There's probably certain biometric ways to do it. I'm sure people would be very terrified to take that test.
If we squish together a little bit of Bruno and a little bit of Newton, you can measure love with a scale.
Yes. And oh, speaking of Newton is also kind of implicated in this whole story, because Newton wrote kind of volumes and volumes of apocalyptic commentary. He was very insistent.
He was fascinated by the apocalyptic stuff, wasn't he? Yeah. Like, he had the
alchemy was part of that too, because it's part of this idea of like restoring nature.
And then he has an allegory involving like King Solomon's temple as a map of the universe and time and stuff.
Yep. So Newton is very much a figure. Again, no direct links to Joachim here, because it had passed through enough people, but definitely catching on these currents that were going around at the time. And yeah.
So, all right. So we've been talking about this for a long time, and I feel like I'm starting to get a better idea of why Joaquin de Fiore and his ideas and his ideas of time and like apocalyptic immediacy are so important for us to understand and for us to have like a good grip on. But so for the listeners, what do you think is a lesson that they should take away from this? Like, what's something for them to contemplate after they've finished listening to this podcast, or they're sort of like, what the hell did I just listen to? Like, what should they contemplate?
What apocalypse do you believe in?
Oh shit. That's a really good question, actually. Like
what is the apocalypse that you are immanentizing at the moment? That's kind of, I think, what is something that we can all reflect on.
Oh man. And those can be political or religious or even personal. Like it could be
Terrence McKenna's Time Wave or 2012. It can be
Global warming. It could be
that.
It could be, you know, the whole State of Israel thing. It could be the return of the Antichrist. I mean, it could be even like inside your own thing, like I'm gonna finish college next year and everything's gonna be better.
Yeah. And then it's like, why do you think that there is going to be an end point? Like, what is this like projection from yourself that thinks that the world will tend to perfection?
Yeah.
Like, where is this obsession with perfection coming from? And I think those are two things to contemplate.
Oh man. So Dan, I have another question for you. If you finish your doctorate and then you go on to be like a mad scientist, I don't know if there are ever historians that are mad scientists, will your supervillain name be Dr. Apocalypse?
That'd be nice. Right. Hopefully I'll have diversified my portfolio. So it could be like some various kinds of apocalypses.
Right. It's going to be a really long supervillain name.
Hermetic, Joachite, apocalyptic, I don't know.
So are you producing any works based on this? Do you have like a, aside from your YouTube lecture, do you have some papers or some book coming out?
That's kind of what my dissertation is about. So I'm sort of discursively exploring all of these ways in which Neoplatonism and the biblical prophetic tradition mm-hmm. have merged and diverged and come to influence various intellectual currents in the Renaissance and in the early modern period. And really Joachim is a chunk of that larger project. But I think one of the main themes in all that is syncretism, because it's like these various, Joachim was very keen on blending the Jews and the Christians into one thing, of course, being subsumed by Christianity. Mm-hmm. But I mean, we can't expect these people to be tolerationists or whatever. Right. This is the 12th century.
Yeah. His one thing was still Christianity.
Yeah. Yeah. It's, and to assume otherwise is to presume that he didn't actually believe in what he believed, that he held to some higher doctrine of philosophical subjectivity or relativism or whatever that maybe modern people hold, but that obviously we can't expect him to have held that. And I'm really just exploring how things like the Prisca Theologia by Ficino, this narrative of various philosophers throughout time. Mm-hmm. I'm looking at kind of stuff like Roger Bacon and his project for fighting the Antichrist, basically, and preparing for the Antichrist by developing geography, developing history, developing the technologies of the Latin West mm-hmm. in order to like prepare for the coming onslaught of Antichrist, and how this project would be recapitulated throughout various generations.
Uh-huh.
So that's sort of what I'm looking at. And I'm cutting myself off with the Rosicrucians. The Rosicrucians are kind of the last culmination of this project to, you know, alchemically regenerate nature.
So you're going to have some John Dee in there, but that's pretty much the last interesting guy.
Yeah, because the Monas is I would say, the last direct link to Joachim of Fiore. So anything other than that would be kind of syllogism rather than a direct influence.
If somebody wanted to start learning more about Joachim de Fiore, are there any good secondary sources, any good books about him?
There's all sorts of good stuff.
Okay.
If you go to that YouTube video,
you've got bibliography down there.
Yeah, there's a big bibliography, and that's kind of all the constituent pieces of that project. But off the top of my head, Marjorie Reeves does really great work. Though I know you would need to find her works in a library, because it's one of these books that are worth like $2,000 or something like that.
Yeah.
I have one right here, but it's not mine.
It's a university press somewhere, so it's worth as.
Yeah.
Okay.
Another book that I really, really, really got a lot of influence out of was, let me see if I can find, yes, here it is. I'll just pull it out. So it is Joachim of Fiore, A Study in Spiritual Perception and History, by Delno C. West and Sandra Zimdars Schwartz.
Okay.
And that's published by Indiana University Press. And this really made me think about how, I suppose, prophecy affected the development of historical consciousness, and made me want to pursue that in more detail.
All right.
And so if somebody wants kind of a one-stop shop, I'm pretty sure that's one of the more affordable books.
All right, that sounds good. I'll look those up and put links in the show notes. Which I mean, I'll link to your video, and then maybe I'll copy and paste some of your bibliography.
yep, the bibliography is all there.
All right. Well, thanks. This has been a fascinating conversation. I'm really glad that we managed to go almost an hour and a half without actually talking about the Picatrix.
Yeah, I feel like I've only scratched the surface too. It's
I know there's a ton of stuff in here. Well, I mean, it really yeah, it opens up a ton of questions. I have a ton of questions that I don't even know how to put into words yet. But it's gonna definitely affect the way that I read some of the older texts now. You know what I look for.
Think about their apocalypses.
For sure. Okay, wait. So now tell people where they can find you online. Like, assuming, let's just assume that everybody listening to this episode has never heard of you before.
All right. So you can find me on youtube.com/themodernhermeticist. That's my YouTube channel. So subscribe there. I also have a Twitter, which is twitter.com/modernhermetics.
Mm-hmm.
So... and I have a website, themodernhermeticist.com. So those are probably the three places that I dwell on the internet. And yeah, that's, if they find me there, they can ask me questions or whatever, and I'll answer if I can.
All right. And also the Picatrix, your translation of the Picatrix is coming out February 8th.
Yes, it is. And we're very excited about that. And we've got some interviews lined up for that. That'll be probably coming up in the near future. So it's good that we got a break and talked about something else.
Yeah, I agree.
My current love.
But I'm also really excited about your Picatrix. I'm very much looking forward to it. And maybe,
yeah, me too.
Maybe if you aren't totally burned out on Picatrix stuff, I'll have you back.
Oh man, I'm helping out in basically TAing a graduate seminar on Picatrix all throughout this winter semester coming up, so I'll be knee deep in the Picatrix.
You're either going to be more in love with it or so sick of it that.
you just like you go into its dive. So I think one of the things we're thinking of getting students to do is take one particular source in the Picatrix,
mm-hmm.
like Al-Kindi or Abu Mashar or Ibn Washiya or whatever, and then go and like do a research paper on one of these constituent parts and how their stuff ended up in the Picatrix.
Oh, that sounds difficult. But it's
nice because you got like 15 or 20 students, mm-hmm. and you can get each of them to do one or two, like, you know, even if they only cover 8 people, that's plenty of nice research, because they're upper level history students.
Well, when they get that research done, make a book out of it.
Oh, yeah. Well, we'll see if it's up to snuff.
But. All right. All right. Well, thank you, Dan. It was really great to hear from you and chat with you about this stuff again. And I hope that you have a delightful holiday season.
Thank you. And delightful holidays to you, too, Eric. And thanks for having me on.
Yeah.
All right. Appreciate it.
Thank you for listening to My Alchemical Bromance. You can find us on the web at myalchemicalbromance.com. You can find us on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, or your other favorite podcasting app or location. If you're enjoying the podcast, you can support us for as little as $1 a month through the Arnomancy Patreon campaign at patreon.com/arnomancy. You can find a link to that in the show notes or other places on the website. We hope that you are having a delightful holiday season, and we will see you again in 2019.